the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
But our first guest this morning has really been through some ups and downs in life and business, despite the fact that he's only in his early 40s. Kevin O'Loughlin founded Nostra Technologies almost 20 years ago. It now employs 400 people, operates in 9 countries, has 40,000 end users in Ireland alone, and has completed 10 acquisitions, 6 in the last 12 months. Nostra builds IT systems for companies and provides the whole package from tech support to servers to security. Kevin, you're very welcome. We'll get on to the company shortly, but your own story, you grew up in rural Laois, the son of a farmer and an IFA official. Your dad was also a factory owner, a publican and a shopkeeper. It sounds like a very busy house.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, looking back, it was madness, but when you were living in it, it was just normal life. But yeah, you know, my dad witnessed his own father's passing in a farm accident in 1959. He was 9, and you know, it was an incident that he never personally got over.
What happened, Kevin?
He was pulling. Himself and his dad were on the farm with dad's brother and sister, who would have been younger than him. He would have been 9, and the other two would have been, say, 7 and 6, kind of thing. And they were pulling trees out of the ground by wrapping a chain around the tree and then pulling it out with a tractor. Dad got bored driving the tractor, imagine, at 9, and they swapped. And the first tree that his father pulled out of the ground, the tractor effectively tipped over and crushed them. And, you know, the three kids actually ran in 3 different directions to try and get help, but there was nothing could be done.
That must have been really traumatic for him. Did you see in him the impact that that had on him when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I probably wasn't aware of it when I was a young child, but, you know, when I got into my teens and late teens and 20s and 30s, but I'd say it drove me. You know, they grew up in a pretty tough environment. Obviously, that is a family of 10 kids. You know, they were all kind of under 15 when his dad died, and he took over management of the farm when I think he was 13 or 14 and ran it for you know, I think 8 or 10 or 12 years. I'm not sure the time frame. And that work ethic would have been there, and I think because they would have had such a humble upbringing, he was determined to make something of himself and to give more to you know, his kids than he would have got himself.
And that would have driven him. But when he reflected back on it, I'm sure that he was scarred by the experience. But did he feel guilt? Did he blame himself in any way for it?
I'd say he did all of that, you know. One of the things I would say is he never spoke about it. It had that level of an impact on him for his whole life, and it wasn't until he himself was told he had a couple of months to live that he actually even told the story.
So your dad, very much affected by that, you believe that was a driving force for him to want more and to want better for himself and for his children in particular. And that meant was he a workaholic?
I'd say definitely he was a workaholic, yeah. I was reflecting on it recently, you know, and I actually asked my mum's sister. I said, you know, what did everyone think when, you know, in 1987, dad worked full time in the IFA in Dublin, and he bought and had a farm, and he bought the local pub, shop, and post office, and mum with 5 children underneath the age of 8. Was handed a pub and a shop and a post office to run, along with bringing up 5 kids as he headed off to Dublin at 7 o'clock every morning in the car and got home at 7 o'clock in the evening, you know, and then he'd work in the pub until closing time and did that 5 days a week, and then farming on Saturday and Sunday. It was a full-on...
How did your mum feel about that?
Well, you know, at the time, we were all too young to realise, but, you know, as my aunt said to me, that was Tom. You know, it was who he was, and everyone kind of knew he was a bit mad, and Mam knew who he was as well. And I think, you know, he had a desire to be ahead and to build a life for us.
So what kind of an expectation was there on you and your siblings that you would be all hands to the pump and help out, whether it was in the pub or whether it was on the farm?
It was funny. It never felt like it an expectation, but you were always doing it. I mean, you wouldn't be sitting down. You used to have this thing, you know, take your hands out your pockets if we were anywhere. You know, we always had to be doing something, you know.
But he must have been doing stuff on the farm or practically in the middle of the night with those kind of hours that he was working.
No, we'd get a phone call to say that there's cattle after breaking out of a field, and he'd pull one of us out of bed, and you'd be get the cattle back in the field, and then you'd be left standing there with your two hands out to make sure they didn't break out again when he got off to get fencing material and barbed wire to get it all back up and running. And you could be there for 45 minutes wondering, is he ever going to come back? You
know, no room for error, no mistakes.
No room for error, no. Like, I won't use the expletives he used, but I remember the first time I drove a car on the road, and there was a whole lot of cattle running towards his car at the time. And he informed me in the most unpolite way to get in the car and move it. I was probably about 11 at the time. and that was my first driving experience on my own.
Right. And what about school? Were you, you know, because of all that, did you have sort of one eye to the world of work, or were you very engaged with school?
I was probably the least academic of the family. And I always found school tough, boredom and unable to concentrate. And, you know, I would have been probably right in the middle of any class. You know, take 20 people in the class, I was probably somewhere bang in the average or middle. Except for Irish, where I was at the very bottom. So Dad never would have put pressure on us from a school perspective, you know, and Mam, I mean, they only ever wanted us to do the best that we could do.
And what did you want to do? Because you were interested in computers at a very early age.
Yeah, so Dad bought, for those who would remember early tech, so he bought an Amstrad 30, which was an 8088, if anyone knows what that is, processor. So it was before, just slightly before the current iteration of PCs existed. We got that in about 1989. And from memory, they were about £1,000 at the time. Now, you know, put that in perspective, a car would have been £3,000 at that time. So, you know, it was an expensive thing, but he bought it. I would say he did 4 or 5 minutes on it and gave up, and it sat in the corner, and myself and my eldest brother Keith would have started playing with it a little bit and got into it, and we had very early exposure to computers. Like, this is pre-Windows, you'd, you know, DOS on it, and you had a black screen that said C:\, and, you know, you're looking at it going, what am I going to do? And learning, there was no courses or anything that we did, and we just picked it up over time. But that exposure was absolutely amazing for us.
But you were also able to sort of turn that into making a few quid.
Yeah, in later years. So, I mean, I was only 9 then. But, I mean, when I was when I went to secondary school, there was no computers. It was in Knockbeg. And I remember Father Liam Lawton, who's a priest. He was a priest in the school, and he's a musician. And he came into one of the classes one day, seeing that anyone had any knowledge of how to use a computer, because he'd bought one and wanted to record music on it. And I was the only one who even knew what one was. So I went down and gave him a hand. And then the school got a couple of computers, and actually my eldest brother supplied them to the school. And then I would have been called out of classes consistently to maintain them. And my skills at that time were probably restricted to turning it off and on again, which worked in 9 times out of 10. I became a hero. So, you know, you kind of, again, at something that early, there's a kind of an awe and a fear factor that everyone had that I just didn't have. And ultimately, so in the mid-90s, people were looking at the front page of the newspapers, and Dell had ads up with a PC for sale for €2,000 or £2,000, it would have been at the time. And I used to go and actually say to somebody, you know, pick an ad off the paper, the one that you want, and I'll make it for, you know, 40% less in price. And I used to do that, and I'd make, you know, not money, but one a month, and only take a couple of hours, but you'd be making at that time probably €500 or €600 per PC and go and fit it in somebody's house. So it was a really easy way to make money.
That was very good money.
Yeah, it was great.
And you went on to college, you went to DCU and you studied computers, probably on the back of that experience and that interest, but it wasn't really for you.
Very quickly I realised it wasn't for me because, you know, it's about sitting in front of a computer and working on it and writing programmes, and I was actually pretty good at it, but I hated the isolation of it and, you know, the headphones on, listening to music, trying to write a programme. You know, I'd say if I was to go back and give myself advice, I would have done a commerce degree and a business degree somewhere. And that's actually what interests me. It was the people side of it. And actually in the technology space, there's not a huge volume of people who understand the people and the tech side.
So you pulled out of it and you needed to get a job. You weren't necessarily going to stay in Dublin and not work. Your folks mightn't have been too happy about that.
No, well, I opted for forgiveness rather than permission, and I actually dropped out of school, and I decided I was going to drop out, I'd say around the first week of December of my first year in college. It was only a couple of months in. I think my exact stat is something like I'd done 13 lectures and I was out. I applied for jobs at Dell. They rejected me. I applied to Gateway Computers at the time. They rejected me. And I applied for a company on Baggot Street called TypeTech, which still exists. And I got a job in a help desk there. And then with the job offer from them on £11,500 a year, which is a decent salary at the time, as a starter, I informed my dad that I was leaving. And don't worry, I was going to be self-sufficient and I'd look after all my own bills and I'd go back to college the next September, which was a key part of it. And he said, that's fine, but just so as you know, you're being cut off from me financially from this moment. And when you go back to college, I'll turn it back on. But if you're not in college, you're working and you're paying your own way.
You did really well then in TypeTech, and your salary, your income would have grown.
Yeah, like, you know, again, we're at a time when technology was only taking off, you know, like very few people would have had email addresses even back then. I remember just to give you a sample of what 99 was like so, or 98, 99, right? So I remember having a conversation with somebody who had sent a e-card, right, a birthday e-card to somebody from the States to Ireland, and they sent it 5 days in advance because they didn't know how long it would take to get over, right? That was, you know, so technology was very much in its infancy. So, you know, I had, at that point, starting out at 19, I had a lot of experience in PCs and networking and building them and everything else. So I started in a company that, ultimately, I was able to use those skills, and I was able to very quickly move from being an engineer to being a service manager to being a salesperson to being a sales manager, all within a couple of years. And I pretty much doubled my salary every year for the 7 years I was there.
And did I read somewhere you bought yourself something a very nice piece of kit for your 25th birthday?
Yeah, so because I was earning quite a bit of money at the time, I wasn't a big personal spender, so I was buying property and renting them out, and I was buying and I was doing really well. And you know, not that you couldn't possibly, like, a property in the early 90s or early noughties, you know, you bought something on a Friday, you decided the following Friday you didn't want to buy it, and it's already gone up by 40 grand, and it's like, okay, well, like, I have to buy it now. Like, it was a very weird time. And you know, I would have built an ego that was, you know, based on the fact that I really was an expert at property, which I absolutely was not. I was just at a time when you could not lose. And I did very well. So on my 25th birthday, I bought myself a Ferrari.
It was just to drive it around County Leash, was it?
Yeah, well, it was a left-hand drive Ferrari Mondial, for those who know them. So a lot of people wouldn't even define it as a Ferrari, but and that was a huge milestone for me. And probably a day I realised that my life wasn't what I wanted, because I drove out of the dealership in the Ferrari on my own, and I don't think I was ever as lonely in my life, going, you know, nothing is great unless you have somebody to share it with, and I didn't have that at that time.
And was that a kind of a realisation, because you were saying that the property thing was going so well, it felt easy. You thought maybe you knew a lot about property. It might have been a bit of an ego thing. Was the car part of all that?
No, you know, interestingly, the car probably wasn't part of that. I think, you know, where I would say the ego came from, you know, you almost feel like you're invincible. You feel like No matter what you do, you're gonna do well. You know, you know, I would have been prepared to empty my bank account every month to buy property at that time, because you know it's going to fill up again the next month. It was a world where I had never experienced a downturn, so you didn't prepare for it in any way. And when the downturn came, you know, I had no reserves to actually handle it, and that was put me into a really difficult spin. I actually watched a video once, which was sent around 2009 or 10, and it summed up the Celtic Tiger. And it was basically two lions in the middle of a desert sitting beside a tree, the only tree in the desert. And there's a gazelle running as fast as it possibly can. And the two lions are looking up and seeing the gazelle, and all of a sudden the gazelle hits the tree, dies. The lion doesn't have to do anything. It gets up and it has its lunch. And the difference being, in the Celtic Tiger days, people like me selling and doing business, you didn't have to do anything other than be there. And I think in 08, when the crash happened and hit hard, all the people who had worked from kind of 95 till 05 didn't actually know how to go out and hunt, if that makes sense.
They'd been sitting around the money tree for a long time.
Yes. And I was certainly one of those. And I had a 6-year, you know, lesson in life and how to come out of that. And that was from 08 till 14, an incredibly difficult period.
Just prior to that, in 2006, you got divorced. And for you, there was a sense of a big change for yourself, how you saw yourself and in your own life at that time.
Yeah, so like, you know, you go through a life-changing event, right? In my case, you know, I had lived a life which probably wasn't me to a certain extent. And you realise, you get to a point where you're sitting at home on your own with all the success in the world, and you feel totally unfulfilled. You feel totally alone. And I really hit a low that I didn't think I ever would. And, you know, I started looking at only the negatives in life. And ultimately, I decided I needed to change my life, and I quit my job. I decided to go traveling the world. I went in search of happiness, because I realised financial stability or money certainly didn't bring it. So I needed to figure out what it was. And I went, I started a journey at that time, which really took me 6 or 7 years to go through it, and lots of mistakes along the way.
And it was after you left Ireland to head off and do some travelling that you got the idea that was going to lead to the business that you set up and have grown since then.
I met a guy at the top floor of the Marriott Hotel in Warsaw, and you know that. And it's got a bar, I think it's the 40th bar, it's the top floor of Warsaw, which is a very flat city, so you're looking up over the whole city, a spectacular location. And he was talking about virtualization, VMware, and how you no longer needed to have 10 servers, you only needed to have one in an organization. And it was a huge game changer. Now, I had been looking at this for a number of years. I felt that Irish companies weren't ready to take it on. So my intention was to go travelling for a year and then come back and do it. So I actually got talking to him about my plans after my year of travel. And he, you know, American guy, and he said, look, buddy, you know, you'll have missed the boat in a year. And, you know, the at that time, the Warsaw, the Polish government had flown him across from the US, I think at $2,000 a day to build out a VMware infrastructure for them. And he was saying, look, you know, this is going to come to Europe and going to come to Ireland, whether I like it or not. And I can be first to market or I can be last to market, depending if I want to do it then or in a year. He actually asked me whether I come work for him in the US. So I decided, no, you know what, I am going to miss an opportunity here. And again, the Celtic Tiger was still roaring. So I after a week, I flew home and I decided I was going to start up, sat with my brother Barry. He had an estate agency in Portlaoise, and we decided we'd buy a building in Portlaoise. I'd go upstairs, he'd go downstairs. We'd share the costs and overhead, share finance, etc. And over the following couple of months, I had a number of people approach me to see could they join me on the journey, and it turned into a much bigger thing very quickly. So even before we started, there was kind of 7 people, and we ended up doing it in Dublin rather than in Laois, because the demand probably wasn't going to be in Laois anyway. And we really hit the ground running. We opened on the 2nd of January 2007. And in the first year, we did €1 million in revenue from a standing start, you know, and that would have been, you know, nothing in quarter one. In quarter two, like €100,000, like, you know, 250 in Q3, and in Q4, it was like 600,000 or 700,000.
And in Q1, so it was really flying.
Really flying. And in Q1 the following year, we did 900,000. And then ultimately, the tap got turned off in the world. All the you know, that was around the time of Northern Rock. And decisions just stopped coming in. And we went then from 300 grand a month in our 15th month to 30 grand a month in our 16th month. And we stayed at that 30 grand level for a year. We'd ramped
up. So you would have been losing money really at that rate.
Yeah, we went from, I'm going to say we made about 100K in Q1. And I think we lost 600,000 in a year. 600,000 we didn't have, by the way. I'd put everything into the company. I'd borrowed some money from my dad. I'd put in all of my own personal money and I'd borrowed money from the bank. All of it was gone by the end of year two. And we were still hemorrhaging 25-30K a month. And I hadn't stood up and made the decisions. You know, I was only 27 or 8, 28 maybe at the time. And I hadn't stood up and made the decisions to let people go, even though they weren't busy. You know, we had customers still saying, we want to do this, we're just going to wait and see what happens. And then it was another thing, and Lehman Brothers and all these other things happened. And it was delay after delay. We weren't losing business to other people. People just weren't spending.
That's a huge amount of pressure for a guy in his 20s, though.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I didn't handle it well. I drank, I actually couldn't sleep. With the stress of it all, I had personal guarantees all over the place. I had, you know, obviously some of my dad's money, which I was very conscious about repaying. And I didn't handle it well at all. I drank way too much, almost for the entire of 2008. At the end of the year, I was drinking a bottle of wine at night just to get asleep. You know, I couldn't. It was the only thing I tried. Sleeping tablets wouldn't work. But if I had a bottle of wine in about 5 or 10 minutes, I was able to go to sleep, and I'd wake up at 3 o'clock and watch Top Gear for 3 hours, trying to doze off. But the stress was incredible, and the pressure.
But you clawed your way through that. You spoke to creditors. You tried to do deals with creditors. You tried to give people whatever you could to keep all of the balls in the air.
Yeah, well, I mean, if I think through the years, so 2008, I would say I didn't have much contact with any of our creditors. In 2009. January 1st, 2009, I said, right, I need to cop on here. I need to do something different. And I started training in the gym, which I'd never done. I started eating better. I stopped drinking completely. So literally at midnight on New Year's Eve, I stopped drinking, and I didn't drink for 12 months. And I got up every day, went to the gym at 6 o'clock, and I put a huge shift in. And I went and met all my creditors, met everyone, explained to them what had happened. I took full responsibility for it. And to a creditor and to a person, they were all incredible. Really appreciative of my openness and honesty. And I gave them warts and all, gave them copies of the balance sheet, bank statements, you know, so I was completely transparent. And a lot of them weren't happy, but accepted it. And over the following kind of 14 or 15 months, I raised investment, paid all the creditors back, got ourselves back to kind of a break-even position.
And when things were really tough there, Kevin, your mam died, and you were in the middle of trying to sort out all of this when her funeral was on. How difficult was that?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. You know, I'm gonna try and get through this without getting emotional. But you know, so she was diagnosed in March of 2008. In reality, she was in remission twice. So she kind of had 3 1-year cycles of, you know, treatment, getting out of it, and then comes back and treatment again and getting out of it and then comes back. And the third time, obviously, it didn't make it. Like, it was extremely difficult. And the day of the funeral, ultimately, I nearly lost control of the business, and I effectively rang a friend of mine, a really good buddy of mine, and actually my college roommate, and I said to him, I'm gonna have to ask you for a favour. And he said, sure. Now, this is in 2011. I said, I need 125,000 off you, and I don't know if I'll be able to give it back. And, you know, that was probably half his net worth at the time. Now, he thankfully added in cash. And he said, no problem, will you send me your IBAN? And I did. And I remember 3 months. And sorry, what we did is I needed 25,000 for myself to survive. And I wanted to kind of have a bullet of cash, so at least I wasn't going back begging for money every month, because it just felt like I was in that position for a number of years at that stage. And the company needed 100,000 because the bank had pulled our funding. And you know, that happened the day of the funeral. I remember, like, probably 4 months later, being in Seattle with my buddy and on the back of a car, handwriting the agreement in which I would repay the money that he'd given me 4 months earlier. You know, so when you have people like that in your life,
and that made such a huge difference. And I presume he got the money back. Did he?
He did. Now, it took a while, longer than I had promised. But no, he's done very well. Jerry had acquired in that particular transaction a 10% stake in our business. And, you know, he would have in 2020, so that's what, 9 years later, he would have had all of his money back, and he would have got his first. So he would have sold about half a shareholding then and done extremely well on it. And then last year we did a transaction with private equity, and he would have done exceptionally well. So I was one of the happiest days to see a very large check going across to the US to him.
That does sound like a very large check, the way you say it there, Kevin.
Yeah, well, relative to the initial check, it was a phenomenal return. Yeah.
And the business has really, really taken off. You did sell that stake to some outside investors, which would have given you a sense of personal reward and personal financial security. Because after everything that happened to you, was that something that was very important to you, that you say, I don't want this to happen again?
Yeah, and I think, look, I, to be fair, I didn't actually have that fear of it happening again, because I in the 2008 till 2014, you know, you really learn about how to do things the right way. And, you know, we were building a brilliant business with amazing customers with, you know, who were all long term. I mean, our client retention rate's up at 99%. And, you know, an amazing team around me. So I didn't have that same fear. But equally, you know, we're in a world of constant change. And obviously the last couple of years have shown a lot of vulnerabilities in the world with COVID and the different wars that have broken out and happened, and, you know, interest rates and all those other pieces. So in 2022, if you remember it, you'd huge amount of concern and challenges in tech industries. You know, we were after scaling quite a lot. We'd bought 6 companies. We were at 35, 36 million euros in turnover. And, you know, we were now running a much, much larger business. And ultimately, 99% of my net worth was tied up in it. And a good friend of mine asked me, I was actually in the US with him, and he said to me, if it all went wrong tomorrow, right, and let's say whatever major catastrophic event happened, would I be okay personally? And I hadn't reflected on it, but I sat back and I said, actually, no, I wouldn't. You know, I would need to find a job within a couple of months. I had a big mortgage, kids in school, all those other costs that are there. And he said, well, maybe it's time for you to pay your shareholders who were there with you from the start, and to take some money off the table yourself. And we looked at all the different options. We decided private equity was the best for us, and we found Phoenix Equity Partners, who have been an absolute godsend since they came in, and they acquired, you know, about half the business, and have been there. And ultimately that gave all of the original shareholders and Jerry a liquidity event, which ultimately has set us all up and allowed us to move on to the next phase, which is growth without any personal fear.
Did you buy any other Ferraris that day? No,
not that.
Or have you got the Ferrari out of the system? No,
I'll plead no comment.
What about the future then, Kevin? I mean, what ambition do you have for the company?
So my aim, it's the first time I've said it publicly, but privately I've said it for years, is to make it the largest company in Ireland in the next 25 years. So, you know, for us to achieve that, our short-term objective in the next 12 or 18 months to become the biggest IT company in Ireland. I think we'll achieve that. Our medium-term objective is to be the biggest IT company in Europe. That's probably a 5 to 8 year objective. And our long-term objective is to be the biggest IT company in the world in terms of what we do in the MSP space. And that will make us Ireland's largest company. And we will have hundreds of thousands of employees at that point, and hopefully we will touch and make an impact in the world that people who work for Nostra, whether they stay with us or don't, will say that we were a step change in their development and career.
Well, you certainly have a plan, and it's a hell of a story so far, and the very best of luck in the future. Kevin O'Loughlin, CEO and co-founder of Nostra Technologies, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you very much.